So the paper you're getting today is a paper, a study made on metaphors. It hasn't been done by me, but rather has been done by a graduate in literary studies. It's much more systematic than I would have made it. And the reason why... Huh? You want to know, huh? Okay. It's been done by Bakhtar Rogier from the Dutch BBT. And who has a degree in literary studies. And but before getting into that paper, I wanted to read a little bit about Krishnadas Kaviraj. The reason why we want to study the metaphors is because these metaphors are the typical way of poetic expression. And Srila Krishnadas Kaviraj Goswami got that title Kaviraj, or the King of Poets. So why he actually is Kaviraj, that I wanted to explore with that. And but before we do that, I wanted to read a little bit about Krishnadas Kaviraj Goswami himself. So it is said that in the house of Krishnadas Kaviraj Goswami in Bengal, there assembled a group of Vaishnavas, and one of them was a great devotee of Lord Nityananda. He was known as Miniketan Ramdas. So Miniketan Ramdas was in the mood of a cowherd boy. And there was Sankirtan going on in the house of Krishnadas Kaviraj Goswami. At my house, there was Sankirtan day and night, and therefore he visited there, having been invited. Absorbed in emotional love, he sat in my courtyard, and all the Vaishnavas bowed down at his feet. In a joyful mood of love of God, he sometimes climbed upon the shoulders of someone offering obeisances, and sometimes he struck others with his flute or mildly slapped them. When someone saw the eyes of Miniketan Ramdas, tears would automatically flow from his eyes, for a constant shower of tears flowed from the eyes of Miniketan Ramdas. Sometimes there were eruptions of ecstasy like kadamba flowers on some part of his body, and sometimes one limb would be stunned while another would be trembling. Whenever he shouted aloud the name Nityananda, the people around him were filled with great wonder and astonishment. One respectable Brahmana named Sri Gunarnava Misra was serving the deity. When Miniketan was seated in the yard, this Brahmana did not offer him respect. Seeing this, Sri Ram became angry and spoke, "Here I find the second Romaharsana Sutta who did not stand to show honor when he saw Lord Balaram." After saying this, he danced and sang to his heart's content. But the Brahmana did not become angry, for he was then serving Lord Krishna. At the end of the festival, Miniketan Ramdas went away, offering his blessings to everyone. At that time, he had some controversy with my brother. My brother had firm faith in Lord Chaitanya, but only a dim glimmer of faith in Lord Nityananda. Knowing this, Sri Ramdas felt unhappy in his mind. I then rebuked my brother. "These two brothers," I told him, "are like one body. They are identical manifestations. If you do not believe in Lord Nityananda, you will fall down. If you have faith in one but disrespect the other, your logic is like the logic of accepting half a hen. It would be better to be an atheist by slighting both brothers than a hypocrite by believing in one and slighting the other." Thus Sri Ramdas broke his flute in anger and went away, and at that time my brother fell down. I've thus described the power of the servants of Lord Nityananda. Now I shall describe another characteristic of his mercy. The fact that Krishnadas Kaviraj said that at that time my brother fell down, it obviously doesn't mean that at that time his brother broke the regulative principles on the spot kind of thing. But that was the beginning of his leaving Krishna consciousness. Actually, after that, his Krishna consciousness just went down and down and down. That is clear from this. That night, Lord Nityananda appeared to me in a dream because of my good quality in chastising my brother. In the village of Jamatapur, which is near Naihati, Lord Nityananda appeared to me in a dream. I fell at his feet, offered my obeisances, and he then placed his own lotus feet upon my head. "Arise, get up," he told me again and again. Upon rising, I was greatly astonished to see his beauty. He had a glossy, blackish complexion, and his tall, strong, heroic stature made him seem like Cupid himself. He wore golden earrings on his ears and golden armlets and bangles. He wore tinkling anklets on his feet and a garland of flowers around his neck. His body was anointed with sandalwood pulp, and he was nicely decorated with tilak. His movements surpassed those of a maddened elephant. His face was more beautiful than millions upon millions of moons, and his teeth were like pomegranate seed because of his chewing betel. His body moved to and fro, right and left, for he was absorbed in ecstasy. He chanted, "Krishna, Krishna," in a deep voice. His red stick moving in his hand, he seemed like a maddened lion. All around the four sides of his feet were bumblebees. His devotees, dressed like cowherd boys, surrounded his feet like so many bees and also chanted, "Krishna, Krishna," absorbed in ecstatic love. Some of them played horns and flutes, and others danced and sang. Some of them offered betel nuts, and others waved chamara fans about him. Thus I saw such opulence in Lord Nityananda Swarup. His wonderful form, qualities, and pastimes are all transcendental. I was overwhelmed with transcendental ecstasy, not knowing anything else. Then Lord Nityananda smiled and spoke to me as follows. "Oh, my dear Krishnadas, do not be afraid. Go to Vrindavan, for there you will attain all things." After saying this, he directed me toward Vrindavan by waving his hand. Then he disappeared with his associates. I fainted and fell to the ground. My dream broke, and when I regained consciousness, I saw that morning had come. I thought about what I had seen and heard and concluded that the Lord had ordered me to proceed to Vrindavan at once. That very second, I started for Vrindavan, and by his mercy, I reached there in great happiness. So in this way, Krishnadas Kaviraj Goswami was ordered by Lord Nityananda to go to Vrindavan, and he walked the entire way, being in his 90s, coming all the way from Bengal to Vrindavan. It's totally inconceivable, right, how it was possible. We could see that in itself could have been only by transcendental arrangement. And it wasn't that Krishnadas Kaviraj Goswami was so fit. Right? I mean, he describes himself as being very old and weak and affected by so many different kinds of diseases, and his hands are shaking, his eyesight is down, and so forth. So it's not that he was extraordinarily fit, but somehow or other he managed to do it. So then Krishnadas Kaviraj Goswami begins to describe in the 8th chapter how Vrindavandas Thakur wrote down the different pastimes of the Supreme Lord in the Chaitanya Bhagavat. Right? And that he is the first and foremost of the biographers of Sri Chaitanya Mahaprabhu. But then he begins to describe that in Vrindavan there is the temple of Govindaji. And in that temple of Govindaji, at that time there were thousands of devotees, and they were all worshipping the deity very nicely, and many pujaris, and the head pujari was a very exalted personality, and there were other great personalities. And all these great personalities were asking him to please write the pastimes of Chaitanya Mahaprabhu in a book, specifically the later pastimes of Sri Chaitanya Mahaprabhu, because Vrindavan Das Thakur had not written so much about them. And the devotees in Vrindavan, they knew very well that Krishnadas Kaviraj Goswami had directly heard from Sarup Damodar. Sarup Damodar was the personal secretary of Sri Chaitanya Mahaprabhu, and he kept a diary. It is known as the Kadacha, or the diary of Sarup Damodar. And there he maintained actually a description of all the different pastimes of Chaitanya Mahaprabhu. So this Kadacha of Sarup Damodar Goswami is in many ways the basis for Chaitanya Charitamrita. And also Raghunath Das Goswami kept a diary, and that was also used to write the CC. So then, in Vrindavan, there were many other great devotees, all of whom desired to hear the last pastimes of Lord Chaitanya. By their mercy, all these devotees ordered me to write of the last pastimes of Sri Chaitanya Mahaprabhu. Because of their order only, although I am shameless, I have attempted to write this Chaitanya Charitamrita. Having received the order of the Vaishnavas, but being anxious within my heart, I went to the temple of Madan Mohan in Vrindavan to ask his permission also. When I visited the temple of Madan Mohan, the priest Gosai Das was serving the feet of the Lord, and I also prayed at the Lord's lotus feet. When I prayed to the Lord for permission, a garland from his neck immediately slipped down. As soon as this happened, the Vaishnavas standing there all loudly chanted, Haribol! And the priest, Gosai Das, brought me the garland and put it around my neck. I was greatly pleased to have the garland signifying the order of the Lord. And then and there, I commenced to write the book. Actually, Sri Chaitanya Charitamrita is not my writing, but the dictation of Sri Madan Mohan. My writing is like the repetition of a parrot. As a wooden doll is made to dance by a magician, I write as Madan Gopal orders me to do so. I accept as my family deity Madan Mohan, whose worshippers are Raghunath Das, Sri Rupa, and Sanatan Goswami. I took permission from Srila Vrindavan Das Thakur by praying at his lotus feet, and upon receiving his order, I've attempted to write this auspicious literature. Srila Vrindavan Das Thakur is the authorized writer on the pastimes of Lord Chaitanya. Without his mercy, therefore, one cannot describe these pastimes. I'm foolish, low-born and insignificant, and always desire material enjoyment. Yet by the order of the Vaishnavas, I am greatly enthusiastic to write this transcendental literature. So that was a little bit about Krishnadas Kaviraj Goswami, and we can just see what a great personality he was, what humility he had before attempting to write so qualified, and yet all along he did not write, because he had to be really asked by the Vaishnavas. Although he was a treasure house of knowledge and full of nectar, he would only reveal it upon the request of the Vaishnavas. So then I'd like to discuss about metaphors. It is said, what is the use of a bowman's arrow or a poet's poetry if they penetrate the heart but do not cause the head to spin? Without your mercy, such poetic expressions would be impossible for an ordinary living being to write. My guess is that you have given him the power. Sri Chaitanya Mahaprabhu praised the metaphors and other literary ornaments of Srila Rupa Goswami's transcendental poetry. Without such poetic attributes, he said, there is no possibility of preaching transcendental mellows. From the Antya Lila 195.6 and 198. So that's a very significant quote. Very nice, because it really points out that the importance of metaphors. Below, there is a little definition of what a metaphor is. And basically, a metaphor is that we are using one circumstance that has similarities with another to describe the qualities of that circumstance. So we're using something that is similar, and by the similarity, we can find out something about the unknown. There are two types of metaphors. One is a decorative type of metaphor, and the other one is described as a cognitive metaphor. Now, the decorative is just someone is using flowery language to kind of make his speech more beautiful. But when it is a cognitive metaphor, then there's deep meaning. Right? Then the comparison actually adds to the understanding of the whole situation. So the Chaitanya Charitamrita and in general the Vaishnava philosophy is full of such metaphors, but of a cognitive nature. They give us a deep understanding about spiritual reality. Philosophically, one might say that it is mentioned in Bhagavatam, Yatha Bharka Pratibimba, which means that Lord Krishna is just like a boy who is playing with his own reflections in water. Right? So just as a boy is sitting at a water reservoir and playing with his own reflections. So this is the principle of Krishna playing with his own energies. And that the material world is like a reflection of the original spiritual world. And therefore, we see that the material world resembles the spiritual world. So therefore, it is true that we can, by using material examples out of material nature, we can express certain spiritual principles. Elsewhere in Bhagavatam, Prabhupada explains that because the material energy has been created by Krishna, the psychology of Krishna is manifesting in the material nature. And therefore, through material nature, we can understand Krishna. So in this way, that's a philosophical support for using metaphors. Then we just go to some examples. So Bhakti Ruhir has identified some different domains, and within these domains he has found some examples. Number one, domain of the Lord. The Lord is the sun and the moon. The first wonder is that both brothers appear simultaneously, and the other is that they illuminate the innermost depths of the heart. These two, the sun and moon, are very kind to the people of the world. Thus, for the good fortune of all, they have appeared on the horizon of Bengal. So it's very interesting that the description of how Lord Chaitanya and Lord Nityananda are like the sun and moon appearing simultaneously. Because the nature of the sun is to light. The main nature of the sun is that it brings the light of day. Whereas in relation to Lord Nityananda, the quality of the moon that is particularly described is the quality of being cooling, that the light of the moon is very cooling. And it is said, Nitai Pada Kamala Koti Chandra Sushita Ye Chayai Jagata Jurai, that the cooling effect of Lord Nityananda's lotus feet is like millions of moons that can cool down the burning agitation of the material energy upon the heart of the living being. So in that way, Lord Nityananda in particular has this cooling effect. We also see in the seventh canto of Bhagavatam, a description how Lord Krishna is the one who gives transcendental knowledge. And then that it is Balaram who gives the strength by which one can follow transcendental knowledge. So the first, so in order to get spiritual strength, one first has to become calmed down. The agitation in one's heart has to cool down. Therefore, Lord Nityananda helps us by cooling down the agitation in the heart. And in that way, he is like the moon. So the sun and the moon appeared simultaneously. Then, desiring to understand the glories of Radharani's love, the wonderful qualities in him that she alone relishes through her love, and the happiness she feels when she realizes the sweetness of his love, the Supreme Lord Hari, richly endowed with her emotions, appeared from the womb of Srimati Sachi Devi as the moon appeared from the ocean. So the concept that the moon appears from the ocean is actually a metaphor which is not originating from Krishnadas Kaviraj Goswami. It is a classical example where once, it depends of course where on which side of a country the ocean is, but in Bengal, the moon appears from the ocean. Right? So when the fish saw the moon appearing from the ocean, the fish were thinking, oh, that's just a fish, like a special fish, but nonetheless, he's like all of us, right? Yes, he has, he's very brilliant, he's a great fish, but just like all of us are fish, and he's also fish. So this is the meaning of the moon appearing from the ocean, and how people thought that the Supreme Lord was an ordinary human being because he appeared from the womb of Sachi Devi. Yeah. Then we go to the second domain, domain of the holy name. The holy name of the Lord is the sun. Haridas Thakur said, as the sun begins to rise, even before it's visible, it dissipates the darkness of night. With the first glimpse of sunlight, fear of thieves, ghosts, and demons immediately disappears. And when the sun is actually visible, everything is manifest and everyone begins performing his religious activities and regulative duties. Similarly, the first hint that offenseless chanting of the Lord's holy name has awakened dissipates the reactions of sinful life immediately. And when one chants the holy name offenselessly, one awakens to service in ecstatic love at the lotus feet of Krishna. So this is talking about Nam Abhas, that Nam Abhas alone is, or chanting the holy name, not in a pure state, but rather chanting, trying to avoid offenses, but still making offenses due to inability to avoid the offenses totally. At that stage, the holy name will not be fully manifest, but only the dim reflection of the holy name. And that alone is already so powerful that it will take away immediately all fear from the heart, all sinful reactions will disappear, and one is relieved from karma. It said, so just by Nam Abhas, one can get liberation from birth and death and liberation from karma, Haridas Thakur replied. So it says, just even as the first glimpse of sunlight can drive out thieves, ghosts, the fear of thieves and ghosts and demons is gone, immediately we are delivered from karma and from the cycle of birth and death. Here in number 3 we continue more with moons. This time the devotees are moons. All glories to the moons who are devotees of the principal moon, Lord Chaitanya Chandra. Their bright moonshine illuminates the entire universe. All glories to Swarup Damodar and Murari Gupta. All these brilliant moons have together dissipated the darkness of this world. So there's one example where Srila Prabhupada is being glorified by the devotees for his wonderful devotional qualifications. And Prabhupada said, just like the light of the sun is reflecting in the moon. And the moon actually doesn't have any light of its own, but it's simply reflecting the light of the sun, in the same way, I'm simply reflecting all the good qualities of my spiritual master, and I actually don't have any good ones of my own. So, in that way, the devotees are seeing that actually, any good quality in me is simply the reflection of the good quality of the spiritual master, or in this case, of Chaitanya Mahaprabhu. Then there's an example on page number 3. Murari Gupta, the 21st branch of the tree of Sri Chaitanya Mahaprabhu, was a storehouse of love of God. His great humility and meekness melted the heart of Lord Chaitanya. So, the storehouse of love of God is very important. That is how we should understand senior Vaishnavas, that due to having performed so much devotional service, and due to surrendering so many times in the devotional service, they have, number one, they have gained so much practical experience by their attempts to surrender, and they have received so much mercy from the Lord, so many insights from the Lord, so much understanding has been given. Maybe so much association has been given, right? Like sometimes we learn from other Vaishnavas. Yesterday, Bhuvaneshwar Prabhu was here, and Bhuvaneshwar Prabhu is a very Krishna conscious person, a very serious Krishna conscious devotee, and very serious also, right? And is not into trying to be liked by people. He's simply into saying the truth, right? And nothing but that, whether it's palatable or not palatable. So yesterday morning, I was standing with him in the temple, and then some lady devotee, looked like a nice devotee, came, and she said, "Oh, Bhuvaneshwar Prabhu, do you remember me?" He said, "No." No, I don't. And she said, "Oh, well, it doesn't matter." He says, "No, I don't." And he just kept it like that. He didn't try to remember or anything. And it's being strict brahmachari, he said, "Yeah." He said, you know, brahmachari, to me, he said later, he said, "It's brahmachari. We should not remember any lady, never." Right? This is totally strict brahmachari. So very good, you know, I was thinking, wow, you know, I should be that strict as a sannyasi. And then later in the afternoon, I met him again, and then there were some Indians, and they were typically from Delhi or something, you know, and they had a camera, right? So they were like, you know, "Can we take your picture? You know, we want to take picture with you." And Bhuvaneshwar again said, "No. Break your camera. Go break your camera." Which actually, you know, it's true. They always come for these stupid pictures of themselves. You know, they don't care about the deities. Totally mundane, you know, taking pictures of the family in the temple. Not caring at all where they are, right? No devotion, nothing. Just acting like tourists in Disneyland or something like that. "Don't break your camera." I thought it was really very pure and nice. So sometimes moments of association with devotees, right, leave us such memories, and we learn something. And in this way, years of association with so many Vaishnavas make a devotee a treasure house of Krishna conscious memories. Years of surrender, years of seeing how Krishna is giving different signs, are all giving, putting all treasures in the storehouse of the heart of a devotee. Deep understanding about the scriptures and all these things. Therefore, a devotee is certainly a storehouse. And by serving a devotee, he becomes inclined to reveal what is there. Therefore, serving the Vaishnavas opens the storehouse of his heart, and then we may find out something. Jagannath Misra was designated as Purandar, exactly like Nanda Maharaj and Vasudev. He was an ocean of good qualities. So eventually a Vaishnava just develops more and more good qualities. And in the beginning, in Krishna consciousness, we may be, our objective may be what we do, right? The things we do, and to do the right things, right? But with time progressing, it's not just doing the right things, but it's also how we do them. And then it becomes more important, not just what we do, but also who we are. And then our personal qualities become more important. And eventually, that is the outstanding feature of a Vaishnava, his extraordinary qualities. Purandar, it is a name of Nanda Maharaj, and also given to Jagannath Misra. Exactly what it means, I don't know. Does anybody know Purandar, what it translates? Domain of non-devotees. Non-devotees are camels, that we find also in the Bhagavatam. Saeva Gokara. Camels, hogs, dogs, camels and asses. The camel-like non-devotees cannot enter into these topics. Therefore, there is special jubilation in my heart. So, if we... here in this area, we're very close to the desert of Rajasthan. So if we drive from Vrindavan towards Jaipur, then on the way you can see all the camels, and you can really see a whole bunch of camels around a thorn tree chewing all on the branches. You know, they really do it. Right? It's like the classical example Prabhupada gave so many times. A few kilometers towards Jaipur, and there they are, you know, chewing the thorns and enjoying it so much, right? The nice taste of the branches, but meanwhile they're tasting their own blood. So this was often how Prabhupada used the example of the camel. And obviously the camel is a resident of the desert. And the desert in one sense is an unnatural condition of life. It's not natural to be in a place only dry with sand and all that and no grass and no green. So in that way, the non-devotees are the residents of the unnatural condition of life, the material world. So in this way, if we think about the meaning of these various metaphors, then we see they give us a lot of insight. Just in a simple thing, the camel-like non-devotees, we can derive so many things. Non-devotees are crows, and devotees are cuckoos. Ramananda Roy continued, those who are devoid of all transcendental mellows are like the crows that suck the juice from the bitter fruits of the neem tree of knowledge. Whereas those who enjoy mellows are like the cuckoos who eat the buds of the mango tree of love of Godhead. This time in the metaphor, the crows are, the example of crows is being used for the impersonalists, the jnanis, who are sucking the bitter fruit of the neem trees of knowledge. Why bitter? Because they have to realize that the entire material world is just maya. Brahma satya jagat mitya, they say. They say that Brahman is real, but that the material world is false. So there is no purpose to this material world in the eye of the Mayavadi. For the impersonalist, this world is just totally useless, and it is simply all illusion and pain. But for the devotee, this material world is simply another expansion of Krishna's energy. Just like Prabhupada, in a discussion with Allen Ginsberg, when they are discussing the... Allen Ginsberg is asking, what about deity worship? Right? How is it possible that we worship the Supreme Lord in a material form, in a form made of matter? And Prabhupada, instead of explaining the whole thing, simply said, matter doesn't exist. That settled that, right? Everything is spirit, right? That settled the whole thing. Left Allen Ginsberg without any further reply. And so the devotee sees that the matter is also coming from Krishna and engages it in the service of Krishna and uses it like that. And that is, of course, the Yukta Vairagya philosophy of Sri Chaitanya Mahaprabhu. Nirbhamna Krishna Sambandhi Yukta Vairagya Uchate. Another example for the crows that is sometimes used is for the karmi, the sense gratifier who's trying to enjoy the material energy. Again, in India, you can see these things very clearly. Outside of India, we don't see that many crows. Sometimes you see a lost crow, but nothing much. But here in India, you can see millions of crows. And if you really want to see a lot of crows, then go to Calcutta. But there are crows here. You can hear them right now. Just now, I was hearing the crows. You know, the crows are caught. Again, crow there. This crow is right there. If you listen, you hear the crow. That wasn't crow. Crow. Yeah, now in India you get used to this sound. And if you live in Calcutta, then you really get used to it. Hundreds and millions of crows in Calcutta. And if you want to see what crows are all about, just come from the road from the airport in Calcutta, drive towards the city, and you come past the garbage dump, and there's millions of crows, you know, just hovering over that garbage dump. So it's quite clear what crows are into. The domain of the heart. The heart is a building. Sri Chaitanya Mahaprabhu washed and cleansed the Gundicha temple with his devotees and associates. In this way he made it cool and bright as his own heart, and thus he made the temple a befitting place for Lord Sri Chaitanya, for Lord Sri Krishna to sit. May the Supreme Lord, who is known as the son of Srimati Sachidevi, be transcendentally situated in the innermost chambers of your heart. Resplendent with the radiance of molten gold, he has appeared in the age of Kali by his causeless mercy to bestow what no incarnation has ever offered before, the most sublime and radiant mellow of devotional service, the mellow of conjugal love. I like this, the innermost chambers of the heart, because when I start thinking about it, I was thinking, yes, we have inner chambers in the heart and we have external chambers in the heart. So just like you have to know the Indian house, you know. An Indian house is a little different than a Western house. An Indian house has a courtyard, right? In the middle there's a courtyard. A traditional Indian house, I mean, these are not Indian houses, you know, that we have. These are modern Indian houses. But a traditional Indian house has a courtyard in the middle, for different reasons. One reason is for ventilation, so that a lot of air can come on all sides, because India is a very hot place. So in this way, it's cool. Another reason, it is safe and secure. And in the traditional Indian house, therefore, the family, the ladies and the children, they are residing in the rooms around the courtyard. And that is where the family life is going on. Then on the outer rooms of the house, they are more the social rooms. And if some visitors come to the house, then they are received there. And there are some, and you'll see, tradition Indian house, there is some room where they, you know, you come and they turn on all the lights and it looks like a room nobody lives in there, you know, and they turn on the fan and you sit, you know, okay, and you wait and then somebody comes. It's some sort of like waiting room, a reception room. They have like that, if they have a little bit of a house, right? If they're poor, of course, poor men, the whole family lives in one house, that in one room. That is another story again. But we're talking about someone who has a little money and has a serious house. Then that's the traditional house. So imagine such a traditional Indian house. So the outer rooms, there is traffic with the outside world. So if we compare our heart like that, then the outer rooms of the heart, that is, those are the feelings we share with people. I like this, I don't like that, I mean, these are the things, you know, we interact. I mean, oh, that was really inspiring, etc. And but the innermost feelings, the innermost rooms of the heart, nobody knows.
Right.
These are very, very private, very hidden. Right. We will not speak of that. And there may be something else in the innermost chambers of the heart. Something else may be there. In this regards, it brings to mind, years ago I was reading a book about mandalas, you know, like mandalas. Mandalas are also known as yantras, right? These mantras are means to capture the Supreme Lord in sound vibration. Or in yantras or mandalas, they are capturing the Lord in a drawing, in some sort of... So, I saw one of the living entity within the universe, right? And then with the spiritual world outside the universe. So, the part about the living entity showed various circles, a gross body, and then within, again, a subtle body. And then within that subtle body, or in the circles of the subtle body, there were some sections which were designated as the graveyards, right? So the graveyards in the subtle body. So, in the light of the graveyards, I was imagining that that there is a road, right? It's a dark, narrow road, and it goes past a steep mountain slope. There is a straight drop down, and we are going this road. It's a little dark and gloomy, and just at the end of that road, there is a branch, a dead branch, and there's a vulture sitting on it. And then there's a turn, so you can't see what is behind the turn. So we go this road, and as we are going around the curve, there's a gate at the end. And as we get in this gate, there's a graveyard. And as we get on this graveyard, the clock just strikes 12, but not day, night. Ah, I bribed the chokidars too. So the clock strikes 12, and yes, there's the graveyard, and that's where it is, you know, all the skeletons, right? Don't the Americans say the skeletons in the closet kind of thing, you know? That's it. All the impurities are there, right? And in spite of the fact that we walk around with our hands folded in great devotion, tilak and gunti mala and the whole thing, it... though that graveyard is still there. That's the problem, right? So it is very nice that here the point is made that one must accept Satchinandan, Chaitanya Mahaprabhu, in the innermost chambers of the heart. Which really means that it means again the same thing, the same anya bilasita sunyam karmadhyana vritam, jnana karmadhyana vritam, that we have to give up all other desires, give up all desires to enjoy everything. We simply have to, in the depth of our heart, embrace devotional service. And no other desire is to be maintained, whatever it is, only service to the Lord, only Satchinandan. So yeah, I like that verse very much. Lamenting in this way, Sri Chaitanya Mahaprabhu opened the doors of grief within his heart. Morose, humble, and disappointed, he recited a verse again and again with a despondent heart. So sometimes, I think it stops there, yeah. Sometimes we see how, indeed, within our heart, something builds up, and then we have to open the heart, right? So opening the doors of the heart means letting the feelings out, right? It is an important thing to do, because otherwise one suffocates. So as we're going through these metaphors, as I was reading through it this morning a little bit to prepare, then I was remembering that sometimes the devotees, the very, very pure devotees, are even going further than just thinking in metaphors or analogies, but they actually see reality like that. I'll give some examples. Like Srimati Radharani, she saw the earth, and when she looked upon the earth, she was asking the earth, where did you get these ecstatic symptoms from? Right? That all the trees on your body, they all stand up like hairs, you know, standing up in ecstasy. How did you get these ecstatic symptoms? Did you get it when Vamanadeva touched you with his lotus foot? Or was it when Varaha lifted you from the Garbhadaksaya ocean? Like that, she was asking. And then there's a similar kind of example of some cowherd boys. There are different kinds of cowherd boys, and some cowherd boys are a little older than Krishna. So they are the friends of Balaram, actually, and they are a little bit protective towards Krishna. They have a slight parental touch in their friendship. So they're always ready to protect Krishna. So they're so much in the mood of protecting Krishna that they really want to protect Krishna. So even when there's no reason to protect Krishna, they still want to protect Krishna. That's why when they saw a big cloud, they immediately thought it was Kesi. And they went after him with a stick and chased him away. Right? So just see, you know, we chased away this Kesi demon. Right? We chased him away. But it was just a cloud. But they were seeing the cloud as Kesi. Because their desire to protect Krishna was so strong. So they begin to even see reality like, you know, others might say, you know, oh, here's a cloud, oh, cloud, Kesi-like cloud, you know. But the, or some might say, oh, it is as if the earth has ecstatic symptoms. But Srimati Radharani was seeing the ecstatic symptoms. The cowherd boys were seeing Kesi. So they go one step further. If one's heart doesn't change, tears do not flow from his eyes. His body doesn't shiver, and his hair and his bodily hairs do not stand on end as he chants the Hare Krishna Maha Mantra. It should be understood that his heart is as hard as iron. This is due to his offenses at the lotus feet of the Lord's holy name. Speaks for itself. The Lord replied to Ramananda Roy, "Sir, you are the best of the topmost devotees. Therefore, simply the sight of you has melted everyone's heart." So these things are all talking about how the heart is hard, but how it can melt. It is said that Lord Lochan Das Thakur is explaining that. What is it? Let me see. Paki pasu jure pasana vidare. That the Even the stones can melt by the mercy of Lord Nityananda. So even stones melt. So this is important that we are very insensitive. When we are speaking about steel-framed hearts, we're speaking about ourselves according to the definition of Bhagavatam. Nothing is really affecting us very much. Therefore, when that is the case, one should look for purification. It is purification that is the only thing that can save us. I'll go on to the hardest charioteer. Ramananda Roy said, "The legs are like the chariot, and the heart is like the charioteer. Wherever the heart takes the living entity is obliged to go." So this is an important point to keep in mind, that ultimately, as devotees also, we cannot deny our heart, right? We cannot just deny our nature. We cannot just deny what appeals to us. Naturally, in the beginning, in Krishna consciousness, one is meant to ignore his feelings, because our feelings, most of our feelings, are impure and cannot be trusted. Therefore, the main focus is kartavya, kartavya buddhi, buddhi, or the sense of duty, that we must embrace duty, prescribed duty, and we must learn what prescribed duty is and practice following prescribed duty. But then with time, we can again listen to the heart and act according to the heart. But this must be done with care, because in the cause of following the heart, we may not lose purity. That's very important. So when the heart tends to take us away from pure, from devotional service, then we must reject it. But if the heart is inspired within devotional service, within devotional activities, then we must cultivate it. That's very important. Because unless we cultivate something in the heart in devotional service, right? Unless we cultivate some taste in devotional service and something that inspires us, that is, then we will, it will only be austerity, austerity and austerity. Then we take spiritual life as one big lifetime of austerity and waiting for the reward at the end. But that is not the approach. Actually, the reward is devotional service itself. Susukam kartamavyam, it is joyfully performed. So the heart is very important in our spiritual life. And so there may be so much duty, and that must be done, whatever our duty is. But then, outside of duty, there may also be special things we like to do. Those we should do. That's the extra service we do. That we must do. We must do those things for Krishna that we really like to do. Yeah. Some dreams we have to fulfill like that, whatever it may be. Some special service for Krishna. If you have it in your mind, you should do. I don't know what it may be. Yeah. I still have a plan to one day go to Govardhan and dress up a huge rock, really big one, with a turban and huge eyes and everything, and do a big puja like that. Haven't done it yet, but one day I'm going to do it. I know. It's like, if you want. But I couldn't do it alone, so if any of you would be inspired, we can do it together. Let there be all victory for the chanting of the holy name of Lord Krishna, which can cleanse the mirror of the heart. I won't read everything because we're running out of time. But this is the Shikshastikam, the mirror of the heart. Obviously, when there's dust on a mirror, what can you see in it? So then the mirror cannot reflect the Supreme Personality of Godhead. So it must be cleansed in order to actually receive the image that the Supreme Lord is projecting. In other words, what is being said there, the Supreme Lord is making himself available. But due to the dust on our heart, we cannot see. So Prabhupada says that, somewhere he says that the benefits of modern society are throwing up the dust of material desire. And when we try to enjoy them, it is like causing like a whirlwind which covers the mirror of the heart with dust. There's a purport like that. I don't have the reference. Anyway, we don't have to discuss every single one of them. I think we should just... we can appreciate how Krishnadas Kaviraj Goswami is using, why he's Kaviraj, why he was given that title, because he so very nicely, in his examples, was presenting so many different types of truth. Another great poet is Srila Rupa Goswami, and tomorrow I would like to read some of those descriptions of Rupa Goswami. The Antya Lila begins with a discussion between Ramananda Roy, Chaitanya Mahaprabhu, Rupa Goswami, And Chaitanya Mahaprabhu would like to hear the descriptions of Rupa Goswami's writings. And he wants Rupa Goswami to read to all the devotees about his ecstatic writings. And then Rupa Goswami begins to read from the Vidagdha Madhava. And, well, that I want to start with tomorrow. And it's very nice, Vidagdha Madhava. Also, very, very poetic. So, these metaphors, they are part of what they call Sakachandra Nyaya, or looking at the moon through the branches of a tree. So, one looks at an unknown object, or an object that is far away, to an object that is known and is nearby. And in that way, one can understand the dimension of the unknown object a little better, or the qualities of the unknown object better. So in this way, through these metaphors, we're looking at specifically different the nature of either Krishna, or sometimes the nature of the material world, camel-like non-devotees, and like that. And we get more insight. I guess we'll read a few more, I guess. We have a little time left. The meditative mind is a fishing hook. When one is in ecstatic love with the Supreme Personality of Godhead, one's heart is melted by bhakti yoga and one feels transcendental bliss. There are bodily symptoms manifest, and due to eagerness, there are tears in the eyes. Thus, one is subjected to spiritual bliss. When the heart is overly afflicted, the meditative mind, like a fishing hook, is gradually separated from the object of meditation. Anyway, the mind, like a fishing hook, we can relate to that, how the mind hooks into so many different things. It's like our mind has so many hooks, and so many things are hanging on these hooks, and it's maybe a little difficult to pull it off, but we have to do. So we see even fishing is sometimes used as an example, although it's against the regulative principles, really. I mean, still, these examples are sometimes used. If I do not think of Krishna, my impoverished mind will die within a moment like a fish out of water. But when I see Krishna's sweetly smiling face, my mind and eyes are so pleased that my desire for him redoubles. Srimad Bhagavatam describes that those eyes that are not seeing the Supreme Lord are just like the eyes on the feather of a peacock, the legs that are not going to holy places are like tree trunks, and the lungs that are not used to sing the glories of the Lord are like the bellows of the blacksmith, and like that, the different... it basically said that those who are not worshipping the Lord are like living dead, right? Yes. That... lusty, desires. Oh, domain of desire, here. Okay. Desires are witches and ghosts. The material desire to enjoy the material world and the desire to become liberated from material bondage are considered to be two witches, pichasi it is called, and they hound one like ghosts. As long as these witches remain within the heart, how can one feel transcendental bliss? As long as these two witches remain in the heart, there is no possibility of enjoying the transcendental bliss of devotional service. Somebody who is suffering from madness, right? Being haunted by a ghost means being mad. Somebody who's psychotic in modern terms. How can he ever have a moment of peace? Impossible. How can he ever appreciate anything? Not possible. A transcendentally sober person who with faith and love continually hears from a realized soul about the activities of Lord Krishna in his rasa dance with the gopis, or one who describes such activities, can attain full transcendental devotional service at the lotus feet of the Supreme Personality of Godhead. Thus, lusty material desires, which are the heart disease of all materialistic persons, are for him quickly and completely vanquished. So it's like a disease, heart diseases. Yeah, that is Bhagavatam, huh? The Ritrogam, or the disease in the heart, and that the material disease. And Prabhupada gives that example, how we are all like patients in the hospital, all diseased, and some patients are a little less diseased than they're helping the others. Right? But all patients, right? Actually. Well, I guess we go to the domain of the military on page 9. Because it's not that I'm someone's attracted to military things, but it's almost inconceivable to not deal with the military aspect, because it is really strongly stressed in the Chaitanya Charitamrita, and not only in the Chaitanya Charitamrita, also in ISKCON. There's a, like, Prabhupada definitely introduced a military element, the temple commander, right? Phew! It's like everybody knows. Right? Here he comes. Act busy. Yes, it takes expertise to deal with temple commanders. Could you do this and this service? I'd love to do it, Prabhu. I'd really love to. Unfortunately, never say no. Always say first, you love to do it. And then say unfortunately. When the Lord expends himself in innumerable forms, there's no difference in the forms. But due to different features, bodily colors and weapons, the names are different. The sinful life of the living being results from ignorance. To destroy that ignorance, he has brought various weapons, such as his plenary associates, his devotees, and the holy name. We see such things as weapons and generals, the Senapatis. It is actually said that nowadays Prabhupada is referred to as Senapati. In the Chaitanya Charitamrita, it is Lord Nityananda and Advaita Acharya who are described as the Senapatis, as the main generals of the army of Lord Chaitanya. Thus, the Lord is equipped with sharp weapons in the form of his parts and plenary portions. All these weapons are competent enough to crush the faithless atheists. Right? So, it sounds like it is the old concept of war on Maya, war on illusion. Right? That spiritual life is a battle. Right? That is, it is like that because it takes the same. It takes courage. It takes heroism. It takes determination. One has to conquer his fear and his weakness, equally, just like in a battle. And it is certainly a fight with our own lower nature. Just like Arjuna in Bhagavad Gita has a fight, not so much the fight on Kurukshetra, but he has to conquer his own weakness, and that is the greatest fight in Bhagavad Gita. The devotees headed by Sri Vyas, are his smaller limbs. They are like his hands, face, and eyes, and his disc and other weapons. These two captains with their soldiers, such as Srivas Thakur, travel everywhere, chanting the holy name of the Lord. Krishna was sitting in a solitary bush, waiting for Srimati Radharani to pass by. But while he was searching, the gopis arrived there like a phalanx of soldiers. Well, that's a different type of example. I guess in this case, it's kind of indicating that the gopis were working all together, like a phalanx of soldiers, because the gopis all had the same focus, just like a phalanx of soldiers all together are coming for one purpose. Right? Whereas an ordinary group of people, they all have different goals and different directions, but no, soldiers are all doing one thing. So that's why the gopis were phalanx of soldiers, because they all had the same goal, Krishna. And, in other incarnations, the Lord descended with armies and weapons. But in this incarnation, His soldiers are His plenary parts and associates. Because of the various kinds of ecstasy, contradictory states of mind occurred, and this resulted in a great fight between different types of ecstasy. Anxiety, impotence, humility, anger, and impatience were all like soldiers fighting, and the madness of love of God was the cause. So now we're seeing how different emotions are fighting in Chaitanya Mahaprabhu. Even in material life, we sometimes may have some contradictory emotions. We may be shy, and we would really like to stand up in public and to have a chance to also one time take a leading role. But on the other hand, we're too afraid to do it. Right? So it's like contradictory emotions we have. But Chaitanya Mahaprabhu had so many all at once. Because his emotions were, all of them were very intense and very strong. Here's like one that I like very much. I jump ahead a little. I offer my obeisances to Sri Chaitanya Mahaprabhu, by whose mercy even an ignorant child can swim across the ocean of conclusive truth, which is full of the crocodiles of various theories. So here we are. There is a big ocean of conclusive truth, and we have to swim across, and even an ordinary adult could not swim across such an ocean. Who can swim across an ocean? What to speak of a child, right? And an ignorant child, a child that doesn't even know anything, right? How could such a child swim across the ocean of conclusive truth? And then, in that ocean, there are many crocodiles of various speculative theories, right? So, what chance do we have to swim across? Only the mercy of Chaitanya Mahaprabhu. So this is a very significant verse, because it really shows how we have to take shelter and how we have to learn the teachings of Sri Chaitanya Mahaprabhu. In the Madhya Lila, it says that even one who doesn't have any knowledge, simply by the mercy of Chaitanya Mahaprabhu, can immediately have all knowledge. So this is also can save us from ignorance. Okay, here the ocean is used as an example. In general, the ocean always stands for the unlimited, that which is unlimited. An ocean is just in all direction. If you speak about the ocean of nescience, right, then you can just think that means nescience in as far as you can see, in all directions. That's what it means, nescience everywhere. So this material world is compared to an ocean of nescience. We are just, as far as you can see, it's just nescience all the way, right? An ocean of nescience. So, like that, these metaphors are helping us to become fixed in transcendental knowledge and make it very easy to remember the transcendental conclusions just by such simple material examples. Yeah. Yeah. A few days ago, also in Prabhupada's house, there was a discussion about acting according to your propensity and following the heart. And then the other one was more the side of doing the needful, right? And both of these things are there. We have to do things we don't like to do. There is such a thing as a burden of love, something we have to do for Prabhupada, because Prabhupada's movement is there and it needs to be looked after. And if we spend our whole day worrying about our propensity, where will we go? Jayadvaita Maharaj once told me, he said, if everyone in ISKCON would just follow his propensity, then we would have a big band with a few roadies, right? Yeah, that could also be. Or it's like, so just following the heart in that sense is not really what I was referring to or propagating. No, we must also repay our debt to Srila Prabhupada and for him take on hardships and austerities and do things we don't like. I mean, book distribution, at first I really didn't like it, to tell you honestly. I ran away from it a few times. I couldn't, in the beginning, it was very difficult for me to stand out there in the street and just stop people. I remember standing on my first day on the sidewalk, and there was a clock, there was a big clock, and I was just standing there, and I couldn't approach anyone, and I saw the hands of the clock move. That's how much I was looking at that clock. So I was like, it's very intense. But it had to be done. Obviously, it had to be done. So, like that, we may have to sometimes do things that are difficult, but that are very purifying, and we just get the mercy in that. But what I was referring to is that somewhere along the line, we must do something that has our heart. And naturally, if you can cook nicely, you know, then you develop a desire to cook a special offering for Krishna. And if you're good at that, then you would really like to one time, you know, you come to Vrindavan and then you want to cook the offering for Krishna because you're a good cook. And, well, that is like, and once we've done it, and then when our service is appreciated, either by Krishna or the Vaishnavas, right, that's the perfection of the service. Right? That's the perfection. That's the whole idea. So that's the spiritual relationship in the spiritual world. The devotees, they try to serve Krishna from their heart in the way that they really are inspired to do it and make something really nice. But what they want to see is actually the happiness in Krishna's eyes with that service. They really want, that's what they're after. They want to see the appreciation of Krishna for that service. So, we have to act. We have to find something in devotional service that appeals to our heart, and we should cultivate that. If one has a desire to do a little deity worship in his room, it's nice. Of course, it shouldn't go too far, you know, like just in the room, a huge thing in the room, and never going to the temple anymore, and all day busy with his own deity worship. Prabhupada said, no, the main thing is in the temple. But just if someone has that inclination, it's very nice. So some inclination is there in everyone and should be cultivated. Otherwise, one will dry up. Without a doubt. Thank you very much. We'll continue tomorrow. Srila Prabhupada ki jai.